Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. Today's episode is part of the Special Election 2020 series on the President's Inbox. Each week between now and the Iowa caucuses, I am sitting down with two experts with different views on how the United States should deal with the foreign policy challenges it faces. We hope that the contending views will give you a fuller understanding of what the candidates are and aren't saying on the campaign trail. This week's topic is Iran. With me to discuss U.S. policy toward Iran are Rob Malley and Ray Takei. Rob is the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group, a nonprofit working to prevent and resolve deadly conflict. He has held several positions in the U.S. government, most recently during the Obama administration, where he was White House coordinator for the Middle East, North Africa, and Gulf region, and senior advisor on the counter-ISIL campaign. Rob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Ray is the Haseeb J. Sabah Senior Fellow for Middle East Studies here at CFR. He served as Senior Advisor on Iran at the Department of State during the Obama administration. He is the author of four books on the Middle East. Ray, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Ray, I think I'd like to begin with you, and I'd like to begin with sort of where current U.S. policy toward Iran stands. President Trump came to office pledging to take a harder line on Iran. He withdrew the United States from the Iran nuclear deal, and he has stepped up sanctions on Iran and even threatened so-called secondary sanctions on countries that trade with Iran. You have been an outspoken proponent of ratcheting up economic pressure on Iran. Can you sort of assess for me how, from your vantage point, this policy is playing out?
Well, the maximum pressure strategy, as it's called, I think this strategy has been tactically successful in terms of the fact that the administration has managed to multilateralize its economic sanctions, irrespective of the fact that incumbent European states disagreed with it. They managed to gain compliance. I think they have managed to somewhat isolate Iran internationally. The strategic objectives, which are rather immodest, as outlined by Secretary Pompeo's 12-point plan in May of 2018,
And you would define those strategic objectives as?
As quite expansive. Those objectives have not been reached yet. So the policy has been tactically successful. It has not reached its strategic objectives. I think it's too premature to say it will succeed. It's unfair to say it will not.
So, Rob, let me ask you essentially the same question. How would you assess the administration's policy toward Iran?
I mean, I'm not sure what it means to say they're tactically successful and strategically incomplete when the objective of the maximum pressure campaign was pretty clear. I mean, we could talk about 12 demands, but what it really was two things, the stated objectives. One was to get Iran to agree to a more onerous nuclear deal than the one that was negotiated by President Obama and reached with other countries with Iran. The second objective was to, quote unquote, moderate Iran's regional behavior. Now, you could say tactically it succeeded because it is true that Iran is economically in a far worse shape than it was at the time that the maximum pressure was initiated and than it should have been if the nuclear deal had been respected by the United States. But that's a very short-sighted tactical victory because what we've seen is, number one, Iran is now eroding its compliance with the nuclear deal. So rather than coming to the U.S., as some had said and fantasized that it would come to the U.S. under duress and say, we are now agreeing to more stringent nuclear demands in order to get these sanctions lifted, it is now walking back its nuclear commitment, so we're in a worse position on the nuclear file. As for its regional behavior, just listen to what the administration says, that Iran is more dangerous than it's been, and see their actions, most recently attacking oil fields in Saudi Arabia, probably the most brazen attack that Iran has undertaken against its neighbors, maybe since the revolution, but even if it's not since then, it was brazen on its own terms. So its regional behavior has become more aggressive, its nuclear conduct is less compliant with the nuclear deal. If that's even close to success, one fears what failure would look like. So I think it has failed. I think it's very hard. You know, one could always say, well, give it another year, 2 years, and you'll see how things are going to turn around. But there's every indication right now that Iran is not going to react by coming back to the table. It's not going to react with a change of regime. It's not going to react by moderating its behavior, but by acting in ways that are precisely the opposite of what the administration intended to produce when it initiated the campaign.
Ray, part of the idea behind the maximum pressure campaign was essentially get Tehran to cry uncle to give in on the issues the administration cared most about. Rob just listed a number of them. Obviously, changes in the Iran nuclear deal, ballistic missile programs, behavior in the region. As you note, tactically, these sanctions have inflicted pain, but we haven't gotten movement from Tehran. Do you see signs that it may happen, or are you simply being agnostic writ large?
Paradoxically, the criticism that Trump administration is getting today is not that dissimilar to the criticism that Obama administration got in his first years, when there was suggestion that multilateral imposition of sanctions was not yielding strategic gains, until, by their perception, it did. So there are two ways of looking at the maximum strategy of pressure. One is that it is inherently flawed and it will not work. Number two is that with patience and time, it will eventually erode Iranian solidarity. That's a debate that's almost impossible to arbitrate, because the maximum strategy of pressure really has been in effect for about a year and a half. It took 10 years of diplomacy and pressure to get the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear agreement, in 2015. No policy should be given the deference of a decade, but perhaps it should be given deference of more than 18 months.
So do you see any signs in Iran that there is movement? Because theoretically, the idea behind sanctions is you're imposing pain on an overall economy. Your hope is that the public will protest. That leads pressure on the elites. The elites change their policy precisely because they want to diffuse public protest. Do you see anything like that happening?
Well, in the region today, if you look at all three sectors of the region, the Gulf, Iraq, and the Levant, the Iranian position is worst off. I don't know what benefit Iranians got from what was described correctly as a brazen attack, other than the fact there was a Saudi attack on their oil shipments and 2,000 additional American troops going in, and an assassination attempt against General Soleimani that nobody talks about.
General Soleimani being?
The head of the Iranian paramilitary force. In Iraq, there's a Shia protest against a Shia government repressed by Iranian Shia militias, and that's a very concern. And the Levant, I don't see how Iranians are gaining in Syria with the departure of the American forces, given the fact that Assad is likely to be more brazen and costly for them. Now, within Iran itself today, I would say that the economic arguments of arms control are changing. One of the things that's being discussed widely is, and I think it would have been even if JCPOA had not been abrogated, is the question that the Iranian political elite are grappling with is, what is ailing our economy? And in 2013, President Rouhani had an answer which was impossible to disprove. That was the imposition of external sanctions, and the relief of those sanctions to an arms control agreement could therefore rejuvenate the economy. I would say that argument has been battered. Many people are suggesting that the cause of our economic decline is mismanagement, corruption, and inability to develop internal markets and regional ones. Therefore, the economic arguments regarding arms control are actually, and the necessity of arms control are changing. So I would say, even if the JCPOA had not been abrogated between 2015 and 2018, there was a lot of Iranian complaints that it was not economically beneficial to them. So I think one of the consequences of economic pressure is for the political elite to ask some searching questions about what causes the deficiencies of our economy. And that may paradoxically make the notion of returning to an arms control agreement of rigorous or relaxing less compelling. So in that sense, those are the natural consequences of the JCPOA. Whether abrogated or not, it tends to damage the argument that the pathway to Iran's economic rejuvenation was an arms control agreement generating foreign commerce. That argument, I think, is a tattered, if not a battered one, within the Iranian political system, and that has implications for future negotiations.
I should note the JCPOA is a technical name
for the Iran nuclear
deal. What we call the Iran nuclear deal. Right. I actually want to broaden the discussion and sort of go back. Maybe I'll begin with you, Rob. We just marked the 40th anniversary of the seizure of the U.S. diplomats in the Iranian embassy back in 1979. Well-known part of American history, really sort of shaped U.S.-Iranian relations ever since then. However, I'm reminded of, having just recently reread it, George Washington's farewell address, where he said, "The nation which indulges towards another a habitual hatred or a habitual fondness is in some degree a slave to its animosity or to its affection, either of which is sufficient to lead it astray." With sort of that as a background, from your view, Rob, what is the nature of the threat that Iran poses to U.S. interests?
It's a great question. I would like to come back just to the point that Ray was making. I mean, I think it's fine to be agnostic. You have a vaccine, you test to see over time how it's doing. But when the immediate results are precisely the opposite of what you said you were going to achieve, I think you should stop the experiment. And in this case,
you would have stopped the experiment Obama's policy in 2010.
I disagree with that, but we could come to that.
We'll litigate that in a moment.
Yeah, the problem we have here, if we follow this logic, Iran continues to walk away from its commitments on the nuclear deal, and which means that at some point it will be where it was back in 2014 or worse. And at that time, let's recall, American officials and Israeli officials were saying that if Iran continues, we would have to take action to stop military action to stop its nuclear program. And or Iran will continue its attacks. Ray is right. It attacked the oil fields in Saudi Arabia. There's no reaction. It may now be emboldened. Well, if that didn't get the world's attention, we're going to do even more. We're talking, this program is about next presidency or what happens. Do we want the next president, whether it's President Trump or his successor, to face a situation where Iran has so expanded its nuclear program or so engaged in or so heightened its regional behavior that we would face the choice, do we let that go without any consequence, or do we have to take military action to stop it? That was precisely the dilemma that President Obama wanted to get out of, which is why he wanted to get this nuclear deal. And so I just don't understand how one could be agnostic when we see the trend lines moving in the wrong direction. We don't have infinite time because Iran may cross one of those two thresholds, regional behavior that warrants a response, nuclear action that warrants a response. So that's on that. And I don't know if Ray wants to answer now and then come
I'm
to
sure
your...
we'll get a chance to come back to it. But I really do want to get to this broader issue.
I think it's a great question.
What you see as the threats, what should we be worried about?
First of all, you're right to go back to the hostage crisis and what set the stage for what has been a mutually reinforcing enmity. I think as Ray, whether he said it here, I've heard him say it before, there's no doubt that anti-Americanism is a part, one of the pillars of the ideology of the Iranian revolution, and they hold to that. It also is, you know, the U.S. has turned Iran, I think, into far more of an existential threat than it actually is to U.S. interests. It doesn't mean that it doesn't take actions that are destabilizing to the region, destabilizing to our allies, and in some cases have taken action, you know, the plot, which I have every reason to believe it occurred with some Iranians tried to kill the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C., blow up places around the world. Those are things one could be concerned about and should take action to try to stop. I think we have elevated Iran into a far greater, to think of how much time, energy, and resources have been spent on Iran when there's so many other issues around the world, I think. But that's in a way, something that the U.S. often does. It identifies one enemy and decides it. Whether it's Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi or now Iran.
So how would you right-size the Iranian challenge? What do you think we should be focused on?
Well, I mean, a lot of what we're focused on are the right things. The nuclear program, which had been put in a box and now is the box is leaking. Some of their activities, support for some groups, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's some of the Palestinian groups, I think those are the things that one should look at. The question is, how do you deal with it? And I think dealing with it by deciding to demonize the regime and to say either the regime has to fall or we need to put maximum pressure and not have a diplomatic angle to it. I think what the nuclear deal showed is that at least on that issue, and by the way, it's the only issue on which the U.S. has been able, with others, to alter Iran's behavior since the revolution. Everything else we've tried, and I was part of two administrations where they're different, and you were too, where different things were tried to change Iran's behavior, to respond, and they all failed. So, number one, I think we all have to be modest about how successful we can be on that. But to try to have a different policy that combines pressure with real diplomacy, with achievable goals, not the 12 demands that Secretary Pompeo, which are equivalent to a change in regime. I think the U.S. officials recognize that if Iran were to implement all 12 demands, it would no longer be the regime that we're familiar with after those demands have been met than it is today. But there are some realistic demands that should be made with real incentives and real consequences if they don't meet. And that's what happened with the nuclear deal. So take a page from that. It was a clear objective to freeze and roll back the nuclear program with clear incentives. Wasn't perfect, and I'm sure Ray has written extensively about how imperfect it was, but
we'll
it achieved that goal. Let's try to do the same on other aspects of Iran's behavior, but be realistic about what can be achieved through pressure and what else is going to have to be put on the table.
Ray, how would you assess the Iranian threat? What is it we're trying to stop or prevent, or is there some hierarchy of priorities we should be looking at?
In terms of the Iranian threat, the Islamic Republic is a rather an unusual state in a sense that we have always anticipated that revolutionary states, after a period of time, moderate their ideology for sake of international commerce and re-engagement in the global economy and society. That hasn't happened. So the Iranian revolution is unique in a sense that it hasn't had that particular trajectory. One of the reasons I suspect why the Iranian threat is more pronounced today, and by today I mean the last 20 years, has been basically the collapse of the Middle East state structure for a variety of reasons, whether it was invasion of Iraq or whether Arab Spring. And so you have creation of a lot of actors outside the state, militias and political actors and organizations that Iranians have managed to make common cause with and embark on probably the greatest imperial adventure in modern history of Iran. No Persian monarch ever considered having essentially the colonization of the Levant as their primary priority.
Can you sort of unpack that for a second for people who don't know what all these terms mean when you say the colonization of the Levant?
Please unpack that. I don't understand that either.
Well, I'll try. Historically, the Iranian foreign policy in the 20th century was concerned about the great powers and Iraq. But what Islamic Republic has done is made how people in Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere govern themselves an important priority, which was never a priority for the Pahlavi state, the former Shah. So in a sense that Iranians have spent the kind of money and resources in Lebanon and Syria, which were unimaginable for any Persian monarch, that stems not from Iranian nationalism, but from certain Islamist imagination. There's always suggestion that there's continuity between Islamic Republic and the previous Persian monarchies. That statement is actually not true. When the Iranian revolutionaries talk about root and branch, they meant it. There's a whole new international orientation. And that has been much more empowered because of the collapse of the regional state structure and some of the rivals that traditionally checked the balance of power with Iran. So it is implicated in the Syrian civil war and the Yemeni civil war, which nobody really talks about, as they like to blame the Saudis exclusively for that, certainly in terms of decomposition of the Lebanese state. And also today we're seeing the consequences of the American and Iranian meddling in Iraq to the detriment of the Iraqi society. So those things are actually there. This is an ideological entity that cannot be propitiated by blandishment and offers of diplomacy. It may be has to be contained and may be contained differently, sometimes better, sometimes worse. And if the singular achievement of American diplomacy toward Iran is the JCPOA, then we can essentially suggest that we don't really have a diplomatic approach to this country, because the JCPOA was a profoundly deficient agreement. I don't want to chronicle its deficiencies, because the argument against it are so obvious that one need not enumerate them.
You should probably, since I don't find them that obvious.
We'll come back and enumerate them later on, because I do think it's worthwhile to do so. But I see Rob's jotting down some notes.
No, just two things. Number one, by this definition of colonization, I assume you mean the U.S. has been engaged in a process of colonization of the Middle East as well.
But both parties have expansive ideological missions in the region. That's just true. It's a clash of ideologies.
When it comes to Iran, and this is certainly not advocate for Iran, but I think we need to understand and look at where it has been successful in intervening in the region. And on this, I think Ray and I may agree, since he speaks about the decomposition of state structure. This is not so much a function of Iranian prowess and Iranian preconceived ambition. We know where we're going to go and we're going to get there and we're going to dominate the region. In the four countries that you mentioned, Ray, where they are now present in their broader neighborhood, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, Syria, and all four of them, it is outside circumstance that led them where they are. Iraq is the most obvious case. Without the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, it is very unclear how Iran would have achieved what is achieved in terms of its influence in having pro-Iranian Shia militia, etc., in Iraq. In Yemen, if it weren't for the war, and we could talk about various responsibilities, Saudi Arabia, Iran, etc., but it is pretty clear that if the war were not being waged the way it is waged today, the Houthis would not have turned as much as they have, and Iran wouldn't have the opportunity that it's had.
Houthis being the rebel group.
The Houthis
group in
are
Yemen.
The rebel group, in Yemen, which are Shia, but not exactly the same Shia as in Iran. But there's been a tactical alliance which has deepened, and I had traveled to Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, which is controlled by the Houthis about 2 months ago, and they're very open. They say, if you force us to have only one ally when we face not just Saudi Arabia, but it's the United Arab Emirates and the United States indirectly and the UK indirectly, etc., we will turn to that ally and deepen our ties because they're giving us military assistance and they give us training. They're not quite as open as I just stated it, but that's the clear undercurrent of what they're saying. They're aligned.
Well, for them, the Iranians are the only game in town.
Absolutely. And for Iran, what an opportunity to bleed Saudi Arabia on the cheap thanks to this war. Lebanon, again, we get into details, but without the Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon, hard to see Hezbollah emerging the way it has. And Syria, again, Iran was present in Syria before the civil war erupted in 2011. But the more the president, President Assad of Syria, found himself on the ropes, confronting domestic and international military and other forms of pressure, the more he had to spend time with and get resources from and assistance from Iran. And Iran was more than happy to oblige. And when I saw, I met President Assad, but this was before the civil war. And what he or one of his colleagues told me at the time is, when you're forced to have breakfast, lunch, and dinner with one party, you end up building ties with that party. And that's what also happened with Iran. So my point is not to defend what Iran is doing, but to say this is a very opportunistic power that doesn't have within itself the ability to colonize, to quote Ray, the Levant or anywhere else, but is very good at taking advantage of chaos and of building alliances, and very reliable alliances, with parties that have nowhere else to turn to. And again, we could talk about other activities they take in the region that follow this model.
You've both laid out how Iran has been active in the region, and we can argue back and forth about degree of complicity. But clearly, the Iranians have an agenda in the region. What I didn't hear either of you say is why this agenda is of concern to the United States. I mean, if I'm sitting in Eagle Pass, Texas, or Redding, California, what does it mean to me that the Iranians are up to mischief in Yemen, or they're doing deals with Assad? I mean, I pick up a newspaper, read a lot about how the United States has become the world's largest oil producer. It's lessening our dependence, not necessarily ending, but lessening our dependence on global oil supplies. Why is what the Iranians doing an issue for the President of the United States? You want to take a shot at that?
Sure. That's interesting and not an unimportant argument, and you can make a case, and a rather convincing one, that today, for all the issues that you mentioned, it's less of an importance to the United States.
I would note
States,
that President Trump, in broad stroke, was making that argument over the course of his campaign.
It's a bipartisan argument today. Right. Yeah. It's no longer just President Trump. It's when Senator Warren says, I want to get out of the Middle East, and so on. So there are three reasons why Middle East will continue to have some importance. First of all, oil is a global economy. Oil essentially is important for the global economy and not just the United States. And there are dependencies.
So Saudi Arabia oil goes offline.
Yes.
We'll see it at the gas pump here in the United States.
And if that affects the Japanese, the Chinese, and the European economy, given the global interactions, that inevitably affects the consumer in the United States. Second of all, the threat of proliferation. At this particular point, you're seeing that all the actors are beginning to express interest in nuclear weapon purposes, whether Saudi Arabia, and certainly Iran has never given up its nuclear ambitions, nuclear weapons ambitions. And third would be the decomposition of the state structure, the creation of refugees and all that. You can make a case that actually when that took place, it did destabilize European politics because of the issue of migration and so on, and it fed certain populist tendencies in Europe. So it does have an effect, even at the time when the United States becomes less interested and less reliant on Middle Eastern oil. Now, the question is not whether the United States will continue to remain interested and involved in the Middle East, because it will. Today, it has 30,000 troops in the region in some way, in some form. It's what is the type of the involvement. I think the era of the American ambition to refashion societies in the Middle East along some sort of a model, I think that's over. Now, the question that the Americans have to address is what is the level of engagement they would want to have in the Middle East, what allies they want to choose, and which adversaries they want to contain.
I mean, I think neither Ray nor I has really answered that your question yet, which is why the U.S. should care not so much about the Middle East, but should care about Iran's behavior. As I said earlier, I think we have tended to exaggerate the threat of Iran. But that doesn't mean, and on this, you know, I think Ray makes some fair points about if there's instability in the region, if there's confrontation in the region, if there's proliferation in the region, the U.S. will get sucked back in even if it wants to get out. But I think the main question is not so much, you know, should the U.S. engage or disengage, and it's what kind of policies the U.S. is going to pursue, because the kind of policies we're pursuing now, I fear, are going to get us sucked in a way that precisely President Trump says he doesn't want to get sucked in. By further polarizing the region, exacerbating tensions rather than diminishing them, taking at one point very clear sides in the confrontation and saying, you know, maximum pressure and full support for Saudi Arabia and others, rather than trying to encourage some form of diplomatic engagement, rather than staying in the nuclear deal and then trying to get to the next stage, which would be maybe a deal on regional security architecture, which may be very ambitious, but at least should be borne in mind. I think by doing that, we increase the risks of confrontation, military confrontation in the region, at which point we will have to come in for all the reasons that Ray mentioned. So it's less do we engage or disengage, but what kind of region are we prepared to engage in or disengage from? And there I think we have followed the wrong path for the last 2 years by making it far more likely that you're going to see some kind of confrontation, whether it's between Israel and Iran or Iran and Saudi Arabia or us and Iran, in which case, yes, we're going to be sucked back in the kind of wars that, as Ray says, is now a bipartisan consensus we should stay out of.
I have to ask you, because you've both talked about U.S. involvement as if somehow the United States doesn't have agency over its choices. The phrase you just used, Rob, will be sucked back in. I mean, White Houses have opportunities to decide whether to do something or not to do something. Why is there this sense that somehow the United States is almost subject to a force of nature, a gravitational pull, rather than something you can decide to do or not to do, right?
Well, I'll start by saying the following. Maybe it's a roundabout answer to your question. One of the things I have learned from a recent book project is that too often Americans think it's all about them, and it isn't. Some of these conflicts that Rob talked about are not instigated by the United States, and they're unlikely to be radically ameliorated by the United States or even tranquilized. The Saudi-Iranian competition goes back a very long time. The Sunni-Shi'i schism goes back a very long time. The regional polarization goes back a very long time. And the United States has to decide how it deals with the region that is polarized. Now, there are a number of schools of thought. This is not the first time an American administration has confronted a region that's divided against itself, at least frequently divides against itself. In the 1950s, those divisions in the 1950s and 60s were between radical republics, at that time was Egypt and Syria and Iraq, and conservative monarchies. And the United States chose sides. It essentially chose sides of the conservative order against the radical regimes, and those radical regimes were eventually defeated in their ambitions. And sometimes in the past few years, the suggestion has been made that the United States should mediate between these two sides. I don't think those differences can be easily mediated. I don't think there's a regional security structure can evolve in the region. I don't know what that means.
Well, why not pursue a policy of neither, but rather to contain and just try
I think that sort of is what's happening. The United States is putting maximum amount of pressure on Iran in order to contain its influence. And to some extent, that policy has worked. Iran is less money to deal with the problems that is generating abroad.
And yet it's generating more problems abroad.
Well, I'm not sure if it is, actually. Okay. If you have less money to spend, and if they do continue to spend that money on those imperial adventures, then they are suffering domestic consequences of that, because there's a lot of political disquiet regarding why we're spending money on Lebanese schools and Syrian civil wars. The Persians don't like to spend money on Arab civil wars. And this is an ideological product of the regime, not the desire of the populace.
But it's not clear that there are the political mechanisms in Iran so you can translate popular disgust into political action.
Well, there is, in a sense, that you've seen the Iranian regime is beset by demonstration after demonstration that has to take into account, particularly as his economy collapses. If you think about the Iranian economy for the past decade, and if you take into account the projected decline of 9.5% next year, in the last decade, Iran's economy would have grown by 0%. This is at the time when the population is increasing by 10%. So this is an economy in deep trouble. It is actually the only economy that's contracting in the region. I mean, the other economies are growing by 0.02%, 0.01%. So there's a radical contraction of the economy. And there's political discontent, and the regime has to essentially balance those concerns. If it goes to the way of the Soviet Union, namely it privileges imperial adventures irrespective of domestic economic problems, then it will face the consequences of the Soviet behavior. If it essentially makes the pragmatic decision to retract, then it could potentially sustain its power. And for those who are hoping that the Iranian regime disappears, which I suspect is everybody on this table, you hope that they continue to make the same mistakes that the Soviet Union's ideological regimes do stupid things. In the 1960s, the Chinese were offering economic assistance to countries with bigger economies than they. So if Iranians want to go down this road, then they essentially sow the seeds of their own demise.
So I'm sorry, there's one thing we seem to be ignoring in this discussion, at least in your last response, Ray. There are human consequences to what you're saying. And right now,
yes.
I think Most people looking at this would say, yes, it's true, Iran is in distress. Who's in distress? The Iranian people are in distress. And the regime, and you mentioned the IRGC earlier, and we've done some work and others have done some work, they know how to take advantage of a situation of maximum pressure and sanctions. It often is, when you do, I mean, we've studied this at Crisis Group in country after country, when you have sectoral sanctions, by which I mean sanctions against entire sectors of an economy, the ones who know how to survive and sometimes even benefit from it are the corrupt elite who have a monopoly over the trading networks, who know how to survive and sometimes thrive in those situations. Those who suffer are the ordinary people. So you end up sometimes helping those you want to hurt and hurting those you want to help. So I think we can't talk about this abstractly and say, oh, well, if they have less money and the economy collapses, people rise up. No evidence that that will happen. And if it does happen, it could be after a lot of suffering that I think we should not speak about cavalierly. So that's one point, which is, again, I think goes to the, for me, the failure of the current policy, which is hurting people. And no evidence, yes, there are demonstrations, but no evidence at this point that those demonstrations threaten the foundations of the regime, which I think is will be prepared to kill others out of
the
trouble it faces. Okay, but it's not an experiment that I believe the United States, and you said it earlier, and I think you're right, the U.S. tries often to do too much in the region. It should not be in the business right now of trying to instigate a popular uprising against a regime when there's virtually no precedent of us succeeding in that effort. And I think we could look at case after case where the U.S. has tried to change regimes in the region and there's been failure after failure, and sometimes failure that will come back to haunt us, as in the case of Iraq. I mean, one issue we haven't really raised why people care about Iran, and as I said, I think people do tend to care about it too much. Obviously, there's the Israeli factor. We haven't spoken about it much, but it's a fact of life. There are two things in this region that distinguish it from many others: presence of oil. Ray mentioned that, and Israel, which is a strong U.S. ally, and many of the organizations that Iran supports are very hostile to Israel, to put it mildly. And so I think that is a dynamic which explains, to a large extent, why the U.S. has remained involved, rightly or wrongly, in the confrontation with Iran. Last point, are we actually involved in a policy of containment of Iran? It depends how one defines containment, but it certainly is. We're not involved in a policy now that wants to keep things sort of in a status, stable. We are involved in a policy, or we have been under the Trump administration in particular, but I think this goes back further, of really trying to pressure Iran by siding with its foes in the region and hoping that pressure will produce a result. Part of the problem with that is I think it does skew the perception of the balance of power in the region. And in recent months and years, it has emboldened some of Iran's opponents, the Saudis in particular, to believe that the United States would be with them if there were a confrontation with Iran. And so it has emboldened some of the worst instincts of some of the leaders in the region. One of the things we're seeing now, which could be a positive impact of the incoherence of the Trump administration, provoking Iran, but then when Iran takes steps like downing a U.S. drone or attacking Saudi Arabia oil fields, the U.S. does nothing in response.
Can I ask you on that? What is your assessment? I want you to jump in here too, Ray, about the fact that we've had, we'll label them, I guess, provocations. I mean, certainly, I guess, shooting down drones would be a provocation. I would think attacking another country's oil facilities constitutes an act of war. We did not see, at least, any sort of kinetic military response, at least thus far. How is that likely to be read in Tehran? Is that an example that actually would embolden the Iranians, or do the Iranians sort of take this victory, pocket it, and move on?
I'll give a good news, bad news story on this, and then love to hear from Ray. First, I think the good news, which I was getting at, is to some extent it may teach some of the countries in the region the lesson that, you know what, the U.S. is not going to really be there for them. They'll be with them rhetorically. There'll be all this bravado from the Trump administration or from the U.S. But when push comes to shove, if there is a military angle, the U.S. doesn't really want to get involved in another war. So we're seeing signs, the United Arab Emirates reaching out to Iran. Some talk about maybe the Saudi Arabia thinking about it, we'll see. But it could sort of lessen some of the ambitions of the countries in the region and convince them that ultimately they're going to have to reach some kind of arrangement with Iran. I know Ray is very skeptical about the notion of a security architecture, which many people were skeptical at the time of the Soviet Union.
What is a security architecture?
I have no idea.
It would be agreeing on rules of the road about maritime security, about military exercises, about where, you know, when President Obama used the phrase, which was roundly attacked by many, but the instinct of what he was trying to say was pretty clear. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia are going to have to learn to share the region. In other words, not engage in proxy wars in Syria or in Yemen or elsewhere when they have differences, to try to settle them in non-military fashion. It may sound quite difficult to achieve. Other regions of the world have done it. And in fact, most have managed to find some security mechanism which doesn't exist for this region. I mean, you have the Arab League, which doesn't really have any weight. You have a Gulf Cooperation Council. You don't have an entity that brings together Iran and its neighbors, let alone Israel. So My point was, the good news story is it might bring some realism to some of the countries of the region. The bad news story is that I do think Iran at this point is in a position where it feels it has nothing to lose because the sanctions are already exacting huge cost on the regime, and nothing to fear because the U.S. has shown that it's not prepared to react when it engages in behavior, which could, in fact, embolden Iran to decide, well, we're going to just up the ante. We're going to continue to try to take steps. They're going to convince the world that they're going to have to change their policies, the sanctions policies towards us. Otherwise, we're going to keep elevating, escalating a pressure on the nuclear front and on the regional front. And that's where I think the danger lies, of an emboldened Iran that also feels right now, you know what, we're facing economic warfare. That's what Iranian officials tell us. Economic warfare has been declared on us. We can't let others go unscathed.
I would say both propositions can be true. I don't believe that the recent Iranian attack on the Saudi oil installation redounded to Iranian benefit.
You don't?
I do not. Because a number of things happened that they cannot look at with joy. Number one, there's 2,000 additional American troops there, which will act as tripwires. Next time you attack, you may kill Americans, and whatever, President Trump will respond if there's American fatality. Number two is, as I said, an Iranian oil ship was itself targeted. As I said, number three, General Soleimani was subject to assassination attempt that you don't hear much in the world. None of those are good news.
Do we know who was behind the assassination attempt?
The number of arrests have been made. It was in Baluchi area where he was targeted.
This region would be in southeast Iran.
Usually means some sort of Saudi proxies or those who Saudis arm. So in that sense, I don't see the benefit that Iran has gotten. And the number one security issue in Iran today is not that we're bold and Americans are coward, is we are about to lose the Iraqi pillar that is essential for our security. That is a huge concern in Iran today. And if you look at the papers and debates, that's the issue. The Shi'i protests against the Shi'i government, which they then conveniently blame on the United States and Saudi Arabia. So to them, the number one security concern is the vulnerability of the Iraq experiment that they have engaged in. And I said that goes back to the monarchy. Number two, when you have this type of polarization and radicalization that you see in the region, what you begin to see, and I think correctly suggested, is that the American deterrent posture was diminished by not responding. That does not invite Saudis going to Tehran to have a regional security conference in the next, in some Munich security conference, I suppose you have a Mecca security conference. That usually means the Saudis, for the first time, are thinking about nuclear deterrent independent of the Iranian nuclear deterrent because of their perception of reliability of the United States.
So you're worried that U.S. behavior lack of a response could lead to Saudi behavior that you worry about?
Well, I think it will lead to more enhanced proliferation concerns. At the time when we thought previously that the Saudi nuclear calculations were driven by what has happening on the other side of the Gulf, it may not be driven by what's happening on the other side of the continent in the United States. And I think it would take a very long time for the Saudis to develop a viable nuclear infrastructure, even if they have unlimited money and they have to have a scientific cadre and so on. But nonetheless, we see at least the proliferation problem becoming more vexing because of the polarization of the region and the United States not acting as a traditional safeguard as we understood.
Can I just one point? I mean, maybe Ray will turn out to be right. Saudi Arabia has spoken about its nuclear program for some time. It wasn't directly related to the U.S. non-response to the drone attack or to the drone shoot down or to the attack on the oil fields. But they have two things that have happened in the last few months, which I think are at least worthy of note. Number one, the United Arab Emirates has started to engage in discussions on maritime security and other issues with Iran, which it had not been doing before. I suspect that has something to do with their reassessment of the U.S. security umbrella.
That predated the Iranian attack.
It did not predate the Iranian attacks on oil tankers, including UAE's oil tankers. I mean, this is from last spring. So it is very clearly tied to that. And this other thing, Saudi Arabia has begun to talk to the Houthis, the Yemeni rebels we spoke about earlier, again, perhaps concluding that their Yemeni war is not going the way it should go and that they're not going to have all the support that they may have expected from the U.S. and Western allies. So I think this is still a work in progress. But right now, I think there's at least some evidence that Gulf countries are looking again at their security calculus vis-a-vis Iran because of what they've seen from the Trump administration. And from my perspective, it's a good thing that, I mean, that's one of the benefits of the U.S. not having reacted, because I think it's better for countries to act in accordance with their actual power rather than their imagined one.
Okay, I want to look forward, and I want to take advantage of the fact you've both worked in government. As we think about U.S.-Iranian relations, what is it that you think U.S. policy should be trying to achieve? That is, what is the end state? What's the problem we're trying to solve? And how do we go about doing it?
Well, I would suspect that the principal objective should be, to the extent that it can be, is to limit the Iranian influence abroad in this region. And that requires a very robust containment strategy, which means working with your allies and containing your adversaries. So that would be the focus. How well that can be executed, sometimes maladroitly, sometimes with greater degree of success. That's what I would.
So you wouldn't prioritize stopping nuclear ambitions in Iran?
I would actually suspect during the next term of a Trump presidency or some other presidency, there will be nuclear negotiations between the two powers. And if there's a Trump administration in the second term, the Iranians will come to the table because they have no other options. Right now, they're prepared to come to the table, but first somebody has to pay the ticket price. They want to get paid to be on the table. I suspect the next...
What does that mean in practice?
They want a $15 billion line of credit. They want to release the sanctions. They have preconditions. The United States does not have preconditions for entering the talk. The Islamic Republic does.
And I thought you were going to argue that the Iranians are holding out to see who wins the election because Democrat may be more forthcoming.
Well, I just don't believe President Rouhani can be the agent of successful nuclear negotiations, and his term in office expires in summer of 2021. So I think that'll be the task of his successor.
So you think this is more about Iranian politics?
Yes, that's right. And I suspect his successor will come to the table simply because the situation is so drastic and dire. Now, he comes to the table at the time when one of the things that the Trump administration has succeeded doing is convincing the Europeans that the underlying logic of the Iran nuclear deal was flawed, namely that you cannot just have an agreement on the nuclear issue segregated from all other area of concern. President Macron's four-point plan talks about the ballistic missiles, talks about Iran's regional ambitions, and talks about restrictions on the nuclear issue that go beyond 2025. So the Trump administration has succeeded in terms of imposing its template on the Europeans. Now, you know, that's so I suspect if there's a Trump administration and those negotiations do take place, they will sensibly deal with issues other than the nuclear front.
How would you frame the issue, Rob, in what we should make priorities and what strategies to use?
First,
I'm
confused a little bit by Ray's answer because on the one hand, he says there's no security architecture. I don't know what that believes, but on the other hand, he's talking about a negotiation with Iran that will talk about ballistic missiles, probably about regional behavior. It's very hard to imagine Iran agreeing to unilateral disarmament. So by definition, these have to be mutual steps. So I think we might get there, but I'd also say right now Iran's attitude, which I think most people could understand, is there was a deal. The deal was we freeze and roll back our nuclear program in exchange for sanctions relief. The sanctions relief has now been taken off the table. And so Iran is saying, well, I'm not going to come back to the table and negotiate a new agreement if the U.S. doesn't live up to its commitment. So I do think it's possible to come back to talks. And President Trump, in fact, has shown immense eagerness to come back to talks. As Ray says, it's a matter of the price to be paid. I'm not sure the price is going to be dramatically lower if President Trump wins re-election. We'll have to see. I think it's going to be very hard for any Iranian to agree to come back to the table in a situation where one side has pocketed much more leverage because there's no more sanctions relief and the other side has stuck to the nuclear deal. Or what we'll see is Iran will basically violate the nuclear deal completely as well. And then they start from scratch, which may happen. I'm sorry, your question was what I think the approach
should be. Well, if you were going to be drafting a U.S. strategy for dealing with Iran, what would be your priorities and how would you achieve them?
So first, I think it's, as we were saying earlier, it's hard to divorce it from a regional approach. I think a regional approach would be to try to stabilize where we can and rather than exacerbate conflict and try to address some of the chaotic situations which have given fodder to Iran's ability to engage in the policies it's engaged in. But I think beyond that, we should give greater emphasis to diplomacy, not at the expense of pressure. We always, by the way, even under the Obama administration, all the primary U.S. sanctions were in place. The sanctions that had been lifted were the sanctions that
not
are
true.
The extraterritorial, other than very small exceptions.
That's
as
not
you know.
True.
Well, Ray, if you have an alternative history, I'd love to hear it.
I read the JCPOA.
Well, I wrote the damn document. I just took
well,
another.
Then you,
I didn't
you,
write
then you,
it. Fact,
then you misunderstood the document you
no.
crafted.
Ray, which primary sanctions, in terms of why, by that I mean the U.S. being able to do business with Iran were lifted. We could have a separate conversation, but that's just a alternative facts.
I can explain them to you.
Well, you're not, but anyway, the point is...
If you want me to, I can.
If we have the time, but the sanctions that were lifted were the sanctions that are imposed on... the primary embargo remained in place. And as we saw, even by the end of the Obama administration, it's not as if trade with Iran was flowing easily because a lot of the banking restrictions remain. My point, so I think you'll have to put a much stronger diplomatic component. I would argue the U.S. should come back into compliance with the nuclear deal if Iran does, and then do what many people have been arguing, and it's not a matter of accepting President Trump's paradigm. I think most European countries to this day would say the far better approach would have been to stick to the deal, which is a it's not an infinite deal, but it still had many years on the clock. And then through that, then try to negotiate with Iran other issues, whether it's ballistic missiles, whether it's regional behavior, and but with the objective of a, you know, give and take. The U.S. would have to relax some of its primary sanctions if Iran is prepared to take those steps. Other countries would have to be involved, because if you're talking about ballistic missiles and regional behavior, then by definition you have the regional countries that were not involved in the nuclear negotiation that would have to be involved this time. I think it's a far smarter way to do it than to hope, and as we said, it's a gamble that the Trump administration has taken, that Ray seems to endorse, which is, let's put maximum pressure and see what happens. That's, you know, see what happens is what got us in trouble in Iraq. It could get us in trouble elsewhere. I think it's far better to use, again, the one part of criticism of the nuclear deal. It achieved its stated objective for a while, and then the experience was interrupted mid-course, and not even mid-course, at the very outset by the Trump administration, and see whether you could build on this agreement to then have another one. I think that would be far better to keep the U.S. out of another undesirable war in the Middle East, which I think should be...
I have to ask you a question on that, Robin. We have established that experts can disagree on the details. This is nothing new here. But on this issue of getting a future agreement, I think the immediate objection that came up from critics of the JCPOA was that, why didn't you get an agreement that lasted a long time? This was a one whose sunset provision started fading out, 8, 10, then 15 years.
Next year.
And so actually, this is an agreement that was always going to be stopgap. So the question is, what makes you optimistic that we can get a deal that can extend the current one?
Again, I didn't write the that was a joke. I didn't write the deal.
I was
part of the negotiating team. But I would say, listen, you know, I wish I'd bought my house at half the price. I wish I had bet many things in negotiation. There's two sides. These are hard-fought negotiations. Of course, you know, maybe we could have got a few years more. I'm sure the Iranians are thinking, why couldn't we get a few years less? Can we get more than that? There are only some things we were prepared to put on the table. And we had debates in the administration. Should more of the primary embargo be put on the table? The one area that we opened up was aeronautics, and because partly was for the safety of Iranian airlines, which were falling from the sky. So that was there was also that consideration. But other people thought about telecommunications, automobile, opening up more. You know, it is possible if you put more on the table, conceivable that Iran would be prepared to do more on its end as well. But the notion that some people have, which is the only deal that would have been acceptable, was an indefinite nuclear restrictions by Iran. I believe, and I think all the negotiators who were in the room, and there were differences among us, the French, the Germans, the Brits, and others, I don't think anyone believed that sort of a complete freeze forever of Iran's nuclear program was achievable. It was a negotiation, and as any negotiation, it's compromise. I think we had put a lot of time on the clock, and the assessment was put the time on the clock and then see. And by the way, we could always have reimposed the sanctions at any time. Rather than do that, as I said, the experiment was broken at the very outset without, you know, you say we should give the Trump administration time to see if his experiment would work. Why not have given the nuclear deal more time to see if it would work?
Well,
but anyway, we are where we are.
The nuclear deal, given more time to work, it would culminate in an industrial-sized Iranian nuclear program that could operating with high-velocity centrifuges that could essentially enrich weapons-grade uranium.
Years. Not in a few years.
Well, it's starting in a year.
We're now getting really far into the weeds on this. I think we're going to have to call our discussion to a close right now. I do think we can stipulate that for those who argue, as many of the Democratic presidential candidates do, and some of the challengers on the Republican side to President Trump who want to go back into the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, that some of those revisions are going to be expiring. So the big challenge is going to be, what can you negotiate that would succeed it in what you're willing to give up to get it? And presumably from what you suggested, Ray, the Iranians are feeling some pressure, so they may have an incentive.
Well, I would say those negotiations regarding returning to a nuclear deal or a new nuclear deal are taking place in a different regional context, different United States political context, and different Iranian context. So there is no real going back to 2015. 2015 is an episode.
We're not going to hit the rewind button.
Yeah. No, okay. I don't think so.
On that note, and establishing that fact, I'm going to close up this special election 2020 episode of the President's Inbox. My guests have been Rob Malley and Ray Takei. Rob is the president and CEO of the International Crisis Group. Ray is a senior fellow here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Rob and Ray, thank you for joining me for today's conversation.
Thank you very much.
I have posted links to what Rob, Ray, and others have written about Iran on my blog, The Water's Edge. You can find the blog at CFR.org. Again, that's The Water's Edge on CFR.org. If you are not already subscribing to The President's Inbox, I hope you would consider doing so. You can subscribe to it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Whichever podcast service you use, I also hope that you would consider leaving us a review as well as your suggestions for what topics to cover. Your feedback helps us improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in The President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not a CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Anthony LeBarry was our recording engineer. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This episode of The President's Inbox is made possible in part by a grant from the Carnegie Corporation of New York. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.